thank you all for coming. As Patty and I, Patty's my wife sitting right here, as we were talking about our ideal schedule, we were going to have all morning sessions so that we'd have afternoons to go do things. And so lo and behold, I got 8:30 first night. But I figure that's a good thing, because I can say if nobody shows up, it's because everybody's tired.
Or eating ice cream.
Or eating ice cream. True. I thought I'd open this just with a real brief introduction of myself so that you know where I'm coming from as we talk about business, government, and society. I grew up in a real small town in the Midwest, 4,000 people, and we really didn't have any clue what was going on in the world. I graduated from high school in 1972, which means right about end of junior high, beginning of high school, Woodstock happened. I literally learned about that 2 years after the fact. That's how sheltered we were in my hometown. And so, as I talk about the things that we'll be talking about tonight, it really has been a growing process for me. All I knew that I wanted out of life when I got out of high school was to make a bunch of money. So I went into accounting because I figured that's where the money is. Whether I'm making it or not, so I maybe would figure out how to make it. Well, it took me about 6 weeks after I graduated from college and started with the public accounting firm to figure out I hated it, just absolutely hated it. But I stuck it out for the requisite 2 years, which is what it takes for the experience part to get your CPA certificate. Then I went to work for a real estate developer in Florida doing his accounting. Didn't like that much either. Figured out that all accountants do is look backwards in time to say what happened yesterday. So Patty's uncle, who was a college professor in New England, said, well, you got to go back and get an MBA. People see CPA and accountant, and that's all they see. That's all you're ever going to be unless you repackage yourself. So we packed up, went off to North Carolina, where I got a master's degree, and we ended up with four babies. That wasn't quite part of the plan. Patty was going to work and put me through school. The kids have turned out to be by far the best thing that happened to me since I've been. Then I went to work for the bank, for a bank in Atlanta. And this was in the mid to late 80s, right when banking consolidation was at its height. I suffered through three layoffs in banks before I finally figured out, I'm a little slow on the uptake sometimes, but three layoffs until I figured out that I really shouldn't be in the banking industry. Wasn't what I was enjoying, the job prospects weren't all that great. And so a chance encounter with a college professor from Virginia Tech. We were living in Roanoke, Virginia at the time. Our sons were playing travel soccer, and the son of this college professor was a guest player on our team that weekend. And so I got to talking to him and asked what he did and all this kind of stuff. And he said, well, I teach down at Virginia Tech. Oh, what do you teach? And he kind of hesitated and he said, business ethics. Assuming that I was going to give him a real hard time about that being an oxymoron and all that. And instead, I said, wow, that sounds cool. Having been laid off three times, I thought maybe businesses needed some instruction in ethics. So one thing led to another. I entered the PhD program at Virginia Tech, and upon getting my PhD, went to teach at Augustana College in Rock Island 10 years ago. Yeah. So that's the connection of why I'm here. This is our first time at Holden Village. Paul assured me that had I not known him personally, I probably wouldn't be here. So there's the inside scoop. So anyway, it's kind of a strange view of business. I started my career as in the backbone of business, in accounting, the language of business. So I, you know, I can talk balance sheets and income statements with the best of them. But as I've gone through that and I've learned more and thought more about it, I've come to a very different conclusion about what business should be about. And so I'm sure that my biases will come through as we talk tonight and for the rest of the week. I do want to make just a couple of points, and again, I'm going to blame Paul for something. As I was talking with him about what kind of course to offer, he said, these people at Holden Village want to hear you talk for about 5 minutes max, and then they want to talk. So, to a teacher, that's heaven. If I can get you guys to do all the work, I'm good. So I'll introduce topics each evening, and then kind of ask questions and try and get a discussion started. I'm pretty comfortable with going in whatever direction you guys want to go in. So it's much less a set agenda for me than it is an opening of a discussion. The other thing that I want to say is that each class during the five days of the week will be independent of each other. Don't feel like, you know, if you have friends that say, well, I missed the first one, you know, how can I get caught up? There's no catching up to do. And then finally, I will say this, and hopefully I won't get booted out of the room. I was in the Lutheran World Relief Organization presentation today, and then at Paul's presentation on the Brothers K earlier, and there were a lot of theological type questions and discussions in there. I am anything but an expert on religion, okay? My area is business. I think there's all kinds of connections that we ought to explore, but please chime in if you have revelations or see connections about how this relates to religion, okay? That's not going to be the strong suit that I have. And then finally, I'm a big believer in putting things in context. Now, why that's important, I need to tell you. Augustana College is strictly an undergraduate institution, and 99% of our students come to us straight out of high school. No job experience other than detasseling corn or being a lifeguard or something like that. And so as we talk in my classes at Augustana about business operations, I really have to push them to think about the bigger context of what's going on. And so what we're going to talk about tonight, the rise and fall of social institutions, is kind of the first lesson that I do in my business ethics class, to try and get students to start thinking about something other than business as the latest TV ad they saw. We're actually going to do this exercise in kind of a curtailed method. The other thing that I try to do is to bring in areas from many other disciplines other than business. Let's see if I can do this without breaking it. Is that better?
Can you see it?
And one of those things is sociology. Business operates within society's parameters. And we talk about what some of those parameters are. But one of the exercises that we do early on is talk about the relative influence of different social institutions. Social institutions being those parts of society that are organized in certain ways and fulfill certain functions. And if you talk to sociologists, they'll tell you that every society has at least 5 social institutions in common. You can see them up here. And then the exercise that we do is to say, okay, which of those social institutions had the greatest influence on society? And we're talking about Western Europe and the United States, because that's what our students know the most about. Now, mind you, I don't know what was going on in 1510. My students don't know much more than that. And, you know, so we talk a little bit about this being maybe the feudal age, and you know, there wasn't a United States back then, which most of them do recognize. but we spend close to an hour debating which of those social institutions were the most influential in society at that point. And we're truncating that argument or that discussion because it takes a long time. But over the course of about 10 years, these 500 years ago and 200 years ago, these are kind of the consensus of students of which were the most influential social institutions. Pretty clear to them that 500 years ago in Western Europe, religion was the dominant social institution. There's typically some argument about family and government. Most of the time they think that family was most influential because, you know, people lived in very close proximity to their ancestors. Government, their education, the economy and business, bringing up the end. 200 years ago, after the Industrial Revolution, the United States is in existence and all of that. After the French Revolution, the American Revolution, students seem to think that government was probably the top social institution, followed by religion and so on. And it gets a little shaky here in 3, 4, and 5. But the exercise I'd like to do with you tonight is to rank those social institutions today. Which is the most influential of those 5 social institutions today, do you think? The economy. What else did I hear?
Government.
Government?
Economy and government.
Okay.
I think economy and government. 1, 2.
Okay. So we'll put econ, government, 1 and 2. And we can argue about that if we want to. My personal view is, were you going to say something? I'd much rather listen to what you have to say. Okay. My personal view is that the economy is the top, because I would tell you that that is the government's primary interest, and business has undue influence over the government and all that. But that's my viewpoint. There are other good reasons to put government first. What do you think's third?
Family.
Education. Who said family? Why do you say that?
Because both the economy and the government directly affect what the family unit can do and be.
Okay.
I don't think there is much emphasis on family, at least not in my experience.
Okay, so what would you put third?
Drive much.
Entertainment?
Yeah, not even up there. But you make an interesting point. Today, we could actually add several different social institutions. The healthcare system, sports, entertainment, but we'll stick with these 5. Yes, ma'am?
I think education, because I think it has become a servant of the economy. I mean, that's what I feel in our country, mm-hmm. is that education is important because it will keep us in a relationship to the rest of the world. And I don't know if it means that we're really supporting it as we should, but I think that's where.
I also think that the family expects a lot from education, almost expects parenting to happen there. So I think I would maybe put education next.
Yes.
I guess I'd like to put education.
education because so many people spend so much time studying, so they don't even start working until they're 30 years old.
Okay. I'm seeing nods that education probably goes number three. And again, as you pointed out, in large part, it's in service to business. You go to school and get a job. So we'll put the economy there.
Education.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Location.
Okay. Any votes for number four or number five?
Religion.
I think family.
Are we talking about the United States?
Family's four?
I think so.
I think it's a good question. Are you talking about the U.S. or global?
Let's do U.S. since 99% of us are from there. Would that make a difference, Ron?
I think so.
Well, if you live in the Pacific Northwest, it puts religion dead last. That's just simple.
Okay. Congratulations. You all have reproduced Augustana students. Listen.
Really?
Yep. Wow. Now, here's the next part of this exercise. What patterns do you see there?
Universal.
Yeah.
Okay. Over a 500-year period, if we believe what we're saying, here's where I hope to turn it over to you all. What does that tell you about our society? What does that tell you about how we choose to live our lives? What does that tell you about the way we'd like to live our lives versus the way we do? Any comments there?
I think as a Christian, we feel real sad. I'd like to see it go back to number one myself. Because I think religion teaches us, so much how to live, how to work, how to play, and treat people, and make you feel good within yourself, and that in turn will help you in your living, the economy, and government, education. I think that it helps the whole thing.
So let me paraphrase here, and I always warn my students that I'm not above putting words in your mouth. I do that quite often. But religion has a lot of lessons that it could teach us to use in these other areas. Okay?
Part of the change is that religion 500 years ago was the government and the economy.
Yep. And the education system.
And the education.
So glad you said that.
So, in essence, if what you're saying, we could almost do that 500 years ago. Well, I don't want to step on toes here. I've already told you I'm not an expert in religion. But why the slide? Why has religion taken such a nosedive? And I don't have answers to this.
We've changed God.
I'm sorry?
We've changed God.
To what?
Mammonism. I mean, money.
Money is done.
Well, the first category. Okay, I'm going to push you on this, though.
My professor of, I can't remember, but he said we haven't stopped building cathedrals, we've just changed God. Mm-hmm. There's still the tallest building in town that everyone's eye goes to. It's just not a church anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a church.
It's a hospital.
But let me push that point. We've changed gods to mammon. How many of you in here, as good Lutherans, would admit to that? For you personally.
But let me add, if that was true, why did Jesus talk about mammon then? I mean, I don't think things have changed at all.
Okay.
I mean, mammon has always been an issue. People 500 years ago were still anxious to make money.
Mm-hmm. Or anxious to get food.
Let me ask, anxious would you disagree with this ranking?
No, I think what's happened, though, is that the government and the economy has subsumed a lot of the functions that religion used to provide. You know, health care eliminates a lot of the uncertainty and risk that people used to rely upon the church to alleviate. Social Security takes care of a lot of the almsgiving that the church used to provide. The same basic human desires still exist. It's just that we have somewhat different societal organizations that provide for those needs.
But the, I mean, there also is the potential that we see and have experienced of moving our class, you know, our situation of where we are in terms of the class system is much more fluid than it was 500 years ago. There was a sense, it was much more static, and if you were born into a serf class, that's where you remained. You know, what you could accomplish in a lifetime was very dependent on your birth, and which you still do find in parts of this country and parts of developing countries, but the promise that we have is through, I think, a lot of advertising, a lot of things that have been going on for the last 7,500 years of you can have this now. And religion used to promise you can't have it now, you can have it in the afterlife. And now we're not concerned about that. I mean, it's And that has to do with many things, science and discoveries and, you know, what do you believe in terms of all of that. But I think essentially it's that if you can be prosperous now, you can, but you know, you're not concerned about something beyond the grave. This is what matters. I think it's a materialism, I guess, that we live with, and that's our, you know. Why am I worried about what's going to happen after I'm dead? What I know is now. And if I can get a better life for me, you know, and I can get it through either hard work or swindling or whatever, you know, or becoming famous, that's what I want. Money is a promise. I think, you know, in terms of the theme of all the promises of God, it's all the promises of money.
Okay. But as a gentleman upstairs said, that desire for money has always been with us. You had a comment, and then Larry.
This will get us off track, but governments have changed a lot because we've gone to much more centralized governments since 1510, and that have gotten into a lot more things. And if you look at Europe, you know, Germany didn't exist until 18 whatever. Japan didn't exist until 18 whatever. So long ago, the whole central government thing wasn't there, so the family, which was also, the family back then was also sometimes the you didn't have corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
That was also the business structure, too. So going from then to now, a lot of these terms have changed an awful lot, too.
Good point. Larry?
I think a couple of things that are linked are part of for me, in that time frame, the educational level of the individual was empowered by the printing press onward. And so we begin to think, and prior to that point, in many respects, the church was thinking for us, telling us what to do. And they got carried away with power and control, and it got to be something that was not serving the people, and they were started to think for themselves, and it just went the other way west, relative to the relevance of religion, I think, and it went downhill, and you know, the individual
contend the power of society was from religion. In 1810, this power shifted to the government, and now in our society today, in the industrial age, in the age of commerce, the power exists from business, and we bow down to that power and let it take over, rather than our religious ethics say there's a better way, with compassion and care. Hopefully there might be a better balance in there somewhere.
Okay. One of the things that I want to push us to think about here is, as we talk about how these shifted and what the events were that brought that about, it's easy for us to kind of step back and say, well, these forces were in effect and things changed. Well, the power of social institutions comes from individuals in society. We make decisions every day about who we're going to give power to and who we are going to listen to. Now, I don't know a lot about what happened here from first to last with religion. I can tell you a good bit of information about this, and that is that business has made a very intentional, very concerted effort to gain power. Through advertising, through lobbying, through bringing lawsuits that our courts have been influenced to find in business's favor. This has been a very intentional rise. And business has done that with no qualms. You know, there was a great memo written back in the early 70s by the chair of the United States Chamber of Commerce, decrying how badly business was looked upon in the United States and how ineffective business was at getting what it needs. And so the Chamber of Commerce was called to rally to start doing things to get business much more influential. And they and many other individual businesses have done a tremendous job of that.
Well, corporations didn't used to exist.
I'm sorry.
Corporations did not exist.
Right. Right. And that's a great example. We as citizens have allowed laws to be passed that give corporations rights that we as individuals don't have.
Like eternal life.
Especially eternal life.
Yeah.
When corporations were first allowed to exist in Western Europe and the United States, there were limits put on their lifespan. There were limits put on how much capital they could accumulate. There were limits on how much assets they could have. There were limits on what they could do. I mean, it was a very constrained legal document that these corporations had. And one by one, they've overturned all of those, to where corporations basically can do whatever the heck they want. In fact, if you read most corporate charters these days, there's a line for purpose, and purpose is any lawful activity. We can do whatever the heck we want to do. Okay? So, where does that leave us? It leaves us halfway through the talk with, halfway through the class with lots more to talk about. Where does that leave you, us, as good Christian people? Do we just accept that?
It leaves you having to be countercultural in order to live out your faith.
Okay, countercultural how?
Well,
seems like society has our history, has a lot of examples of what we do about this type of situation, where there's a tremendous imbalance. You have a revolution. But people just will take it so long, and then it just comes unglued. You may wind up in a period of chaos that's worse than what you had before, but they will go messy.
Well, I guess I believe that, but I keep thinking that we are, you know how Marx said, religion is the opiate of the people, right? Wasn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the masses. I think that that's what economics has said. Says money is if we have a comfort level that is satisfying enough, I can't see us having a revolution in this country. I think you have to have, in order to really push those boundaries, you have to be willing, it has to be so bad you're going to risk a lot. And I don't feel that is going to happen here.
I think it's true that in the old days, when religion was on the top of the stack, the church, like an archbishop or a cardinal, would make his livelihood would be 1,000 times better than one of his parishioners. And now our CEOs, their lifetime is, mm-hmm. Their income is 1,000 times yours and mine, I guess, on the top of the stack. But they both were cagey in making you feel like you were part of the deal. I mean, everybody got to go into the cathedral. Everybody got to go into Chartres, and feel like they were an owner of it. And they got to walk through, even though they were facing the other way. And they were encouraged to, participate in the glory of the church and take advantage of it and feel that they owned it. And in our country, in the economy, people don't vote against... don't vote to tax the wealthy because they consider themselves either wealthy or about to become wealthy.
That's a weird thing.
Taking Bob's point about the economy and how business sells that idea, how has that happened? I mean, what mechanism have we been sold in our society that tells us we're going to participate in? You all know it's the American dream, right?
Stockbrokers.
Yeah, but what is the American dream?
I'm kind of worried about our economy, because it doesn't seem very stable. I mean, it really doesn't. And I think that, is God trying to tell us that he's still in control? I mean, that's the feeling I have, and I think, most of us had grandparents or parents or somebody that went through the reset, or the depression, and I tell you, their life was on the knees pretty much. And I know I read about Abraham Lincoln too, when the Civil War was on. He always got on his knees to pray, and I think, if our economy gets so bad that we actually fail, or we have an oil spill, and I tell you, it could just happen. Mm-hmm. So I think, maybe we're going to have to get back to God, and God's going to keep control.
But comparing what you're saying with what Mary Lett was saying about our complacency and our unwillingness to revolt on our own, are you saying that revolt would simply be turning, and simply is not the right word, but would be turning to God as opposed to whatever revolt Mary had?
That's what I kind of think. What do you do when something tragic happens to you and your family? Well, maybe somebody would, turn away from God, but I think a lot of people come to God through tragedy. I don't know, but that's my feeling.
There are a lot of... Go ahead.
Well, the American dream is to get the most amount of crap for the least amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
mean, that's our greatest good.
China helps us.
Yeah, and they're our supplier at the current moment. But like the Antiques Roadshow, I mean, the greatest good is that you ripped off somebody and got something for 5 cents and it's worth $1 million.
Yeah.
You know, let's worship. That's.
You asked, you know, as we as Christians, what do we think or you feel? You addressed it as if I was hearing. You addressed it to this room. And I'm thinking, listening to this and the American dream and the revolutions and that we aren't there. But I think in my conversations and dealings with those of us, if we're going to talk about it here at Holden, that we do live some sort of daily revolution. And it may not be bloody and it may not be front page newspaper, but it occurs every day by coming to Holden Village. You've lived counterculture. You've stepped away from all that we're talking about. So I think if you address to this group by saying, what do we as Christians do? We're doing it. We are staging a revolution. It may not make the front page, but it's a step in the direction to take that flip back, if that's the flip that we're asking to go to.
I got a couple things. First of all, are we saying things were better in 1510?
Yeah.
No, I am not.
That wouldn't fit
my that argument at all.
And secondly, have you ever gone back further? Another 500, another 1500 years, and see what that list looked like.
500 years is really interesting.
Well, could you go back to Roman times, 2,000 years ago, and would that list look a lot like 2010?
I don't know my history.
I mean, I don't know that much either, but it seems like it would. So, I mean, aren't we just kind of playing a shell game here? Hasn't the point always been that we're going to place ourselves in the center and get what we can for ourselves, whether religion is the way we do that, or government, or economy, or whatever.
How do you mean religion is the way we do that? I thought the whole teaching of
religion at its worst, is always right-handed power. It's always, you know, that's when religion is at its all-time worst. And it's at its best when it's left-handed power, when it's cross power, you know, it's not. So in 1510, religion was definitely right-handed power. It was really no different than the government or the economy today, in my opinion.
Okay.
So have things really changed? Or are we still doing the same things we've always done? We just have different categories.
Then your question about what do we do is sort of despairing, that is this just the way it always is? Is there,
well,
what do we do?
My aunt? I guess the answer is the one Jesus gave, that he is the way, the truth, and the life. Not economy, not government, not religion, not family. All the other things that we want to place as idols in our lives are never the answer.
I agree with that, but you also look at the kind of exploitation that business is every moment performing against the kingdom of God in the world. And I think that's what I find frustrating, is that the more that we learn or read, we recognize that this power, it destroys individual lives, it destroys children, and there's so many ways that what we understand is the right way to live and believe is annihilated and exploited through the interest of business, which I guess in some way you could say is impersonal. I don't know. I'm not really sure. Do we give business a personality, or is it just this kind of hungry thing?
The Supreme Court did.
Yeah, that's
you have right. Have had a hand up for a while.
I was just going to say, for me, my struggle is just kind of trying to ignore any sense of entitlement that I have. And I know that business and like all the perks of materialism is me and my sense of entitlement that I deserve nice things, I deserve this. And a huge part of education is kind of goes along that I deserve to better myself. And I think those are kind of methods of transcendence for the, like, this is what I can do, and I feel personal power. Or it's like, it's not real, obviously, because I don't have any compared to, like, the economy, but I feel like there's more stress on the individual now, and it's definitely a bunch of nation of individuals all thinking that they have the power because they're entitled to it, and I don't know.
Yeah, one thing that just occurs to me about when we see religion, we tend to think of Holden or Lutherans, or mm-hmm. and in this country, since the founding, I think we've, and lately, there's been this commingling of a certain kind of religion and the government. The two ends of your spectrum, you know, there have been, as you said, the government, or I mean, the economy has been working to get to the top. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me lately, certain religions have been trying to bypass the whole thing and get into the government. And that scares me as much as any other transformation. Because, I mean, there's the church, there's religion, and there's Jesus, you know, and they're not all the same thing.
Yeah, that's true.
It seems like that kind of goes along with what Dave was saying, because humans kind of have always just used whatever social institution they needed to get their top, to walk to the top. And so often in our history, you know, in the name of Christ, we have done these wonderful things, like the Crusades, and, you know, it's like, really? You know? I mean, so religion can certainly be a bad thing when it's in the wrong hands, when it turns to power or whatever. So I think you have to be careful how you use those words. But I think even maybe coming full circle back to your question that you asked 15 minutes ago, which is, where does that leave us as Christians? You know, well, which institution is drawing our society away from Jesus? How can we undo that?
Well, it's interesting because what we seem to be coming around to is that the initial example of social institutions is almost irrelevant. That as flawed human beings, we're going to try and gain things for ourselves over others, and we'll use whatever of these social institutions we can to get to that end, which then does lead back to the question, as good Christians, how do we combat that?
Isn't that part of our fallen human nature, though? I mean, wherever institutions exist, people, many people aspire to power and influence, and it's not only humans, it's other primates, it's birds, it's elephants. You have these hierarchies of power, and people naturally tend to gravitate to wherever the most power exists. And in today's world, the most power exists in the world of business. So some of your most ambitious, power-seeking people tend to gravitate to the field of business. 500 years ago, they might have been bishops. But, I mean, that's part of the fallen nature of the world, right? And that's what Christ was preaching against.
And so is there nothing that we can do about that?
Well, I think so. I mean, look at South Africa. That was all about economics.
You said South Africa.
South Africa. That was apartheid, yeah, but mainly for the purpose of business and you know, the continued exploitation of an economic situation, which just by sheer numbers was doomed to someday explode. And by all measurements, should have. And yet nonviolently, so far, that situation changed. Mm-hmm. And a Christian person and forgiveness and reconciliation as a government practice, yeah, enabled that place to not explode. Now, its troubles are far from over, but there was a real change in a real black situation. And the church at the time was talking about divesting in businesses that did business in South Africa, and was that helping, and who was that, you know, and it was all about money and all about business and all about power. And that
whole system came crashing down peacefully, by and large, which surprised me and still does. But where was the power there? And I suppose there's a point at which a Christian, a system not based on dominance, but based on reconciliation and justice for all, still has an attraction and the ability to invite real change that's lasting to a point that where it could have been worse. It's not always a revolution of violence. And to me, that certainly was Jesus. He was a nonviolent, and Christians from the beginning were nonviolent. So I think there is a third way sometimes. And I guess the other thing I like to say is that we get kind of into our way, that way, this way, the right way, and miss the fact that there are many ways, and there are many religions, and in this global village in which we live, there's a real soup there that Christianity is part of. But there's a, you know, 30, 40 million, billion, I mean, 30, 40% of the world is Islamic, and is liable to be that way for some time. And whatever solution Christians are going to be about is going to have to include that in the equation. Are we going to attempt to dominate that situation, like historically Christians have done? Or is it going to be more cooperative? And that's a question I think Christians have got to ask in terms of what is our attitude towards other religions, other economic and political systems, other than the Northern Hemisphere. But that's what I'm thinking as you're talking.
Yeah, okay. Larry?
It would seem like, to respond specifically to your question, can we be as Christians? I think Christians, along with the other members of the Sioux, if we're really wise, what we'll do is try to keep it all down to a dull roar. Because you are dealing here with human nature, which seems to inherently want a winner and loser, top dog and bottom dog, whatever, alpha dog. And we have the obligation to, in whatever way we can, to prevent it from getting just totally out of balance. And it'll swing back and forth.
Greg, do you have another one?
Well, I was just going to say, I think, at least I know for me, as Alex was saying, a big part of the struggle with how to deal with this economic situation is the sense of being entitled to something. And all the commercials are saying, you deserve whatever, so-and-so and so. Oh, shoot, where was I going with this? And so there's that. There's also the fact that no one deserves anything, especially at the cost of someone else and someone else's exploitation. And I think this is where education plays a big role, because part of the problem is that what's going on behind these things that we're buying and this thing that's driving the economy is so invisible, and we don't know where things are coming or what is going into that. And the more I feel that if more people learn about that sort of thing and if this becomes more open, then maybe this revolution that we've been kind of discussing will happen on a bigger scale, or people will see more of the problem with the situation.
And how, you say education is a key to that.
I'm not talking
about
this. How
do you go about educating people about sweatshops in China and all those other things?
You're asking me directly?
Well, yeah.
Are you in college?
Yeah, and actually, Alex and I both went to a trip to Oaxaca, Mexico, and that was a very impacting kind of experience that we had, where we got to, you know, see exactly where coffee came from. We talked to a lot of people that have experienced directly the effects of NAFTA and a lot of those kinds of things. And those are things that you don't really understand until you see them. So I guess I send everyone to a different country to let them experience something new. I mean, I don't really know. Because you can't just read that in a book and you have to see it and experience it.
I think that actually gets, I don't know your name in the back.
Anne.
I think that gets back to what Anne was saying. I know from being Craig's partner that he teaches predominantly seniors. And this is what his classes are like. They're not really what I thought was, excuse me, but boring business management. It's more like talking about, okay, there's business and then there's business. Where are we going with this, and what are our goals, and what are our values, and what is the vision? And really trying to help the kids see, well, that's your thing that you do. And I've made a point of trying to ask the different people we've met so far, the 2 days we've been here, what they do. And I get the sense that a lot of people here at Holden, they're already doing something back where they're from, mm-hmm. that plants that seed that makes that difference. And today in the Shakespeare class, I saw kids that I thought, oh my God, I've got to follow this little guy till I find his mom and dad. He's amazing. You know, somebody's been planting seeds with this little guy. He's just not normal. wonderful, not so normal.
Okay.
Yeah, and I know in my work, that's what I do. But I can also have really depressed days where I think about the shame that I feel in comfy, cozy little Midwest about what happened to New Orleans in Hurricane Katrina, and that it's still that way. And that's a horrible shame that this country's going to have to confront. So I think we're doing little things, but when I come to a place like this, I get a high thinking, I can do more.
You got a hand up a while ago.
Yeah, I agree with what Claire had to say about education, and you can see how both 500 and 200 years ago that there was some importance in education, but you can see now that it's becoming more relevant. And in terms of exploitation, like, nothing has really changed in the past 500 years. It's like there's always been some kind of exploitation, but now we just become more aware of it and are realizing that it's not good. And so we're trying to do our best to educate more, like, the younger generation about that. And that's part of the reason why education is starting to become more relevant in our society.
I hope you're right, that education is helping young people see those things that are wrong with the world. What I'm afraid of is we have a lot of students your age who are coming there because that's the way you get a good job.
Right.
And that, to me, is, even though I teach in the business area, that's exactly the wrong reason to get an education.
Right.
Yes,
ma'am. I'm just kind of going to back up my little thing about let's send people into other countries. I was looking at this and thinking that as economy has risen in its dominance, that kind of goes along with globalization of the world. And in the 1500s, people didn't really, it was very much more limited. And now as the economy's grown, the market's grown, and globalization has grown, and maybe that's part of the reason that religion has fallen, is because there's, like, we're being exposed to a greater variety of different beliefs, and it hasn't really worked out so well to just come in and, like, take over as far as religion goes. You can't dominate beliefs that way. So maybe it's like, let's not talk about that, let's kind of shove that aside and work on something we can all agree on, which is money, great. But so I would ideally love to see people using globalization to kind of then counter that, and globalization paired with education, because now we, like, the world is so much more open and we can travel from one continent to another, and so I don't know how, but somehow to use that to really understand what's going on and to learn and to better the system.
I think the whole family thing has been kind of overlooked in the conversation. I worked at a middle school with kids, and a majority of their time spent at school, but also they go home to horrible families, and they aren't really taught any sort of core values. And I just think, like, I don't think family really means very much anymore. And so they come to school, treat others how their parents treat them, and then it just repeats itself generation to generation to generation to generation. I don't know if that comes from religion or, but it's definitely been a huge, I think there's been a huge decline in the family.
Good point.
you've had a hand up for a while, Ron and Mary Ellen.
Well, I agree with, you know, in a perfect world, we could get everyone to see those third world countries and actually experience them. But I think there's a lot of power in your story, you know. So if you have had that opportunity to go, I think as Christians, that's one of our calling, is to share our story. And I also feel, you know, great hope with this current generation. I teach in high school, and then my kids are in college, and there's just a lot of hope in how attitudes are changing. I just really sense, at least the kids that I'm hanging around, that the almighty dollar isn't the do-all, end-all anymore. You're in the business field, so you probably get a higher percentage of those I need a good job thing, possibly. But I just really feel like this generation is starting to turn towards service, and it's really exciting. Colleges are really emphasizing that. You have to have done service. High schools have a lot of service opportunity, and the kids are just, I don't know, I'm really encouraged by this generation.
Well, it's interesting. I tend to be a person that sees the glass half empty.
I
am not an optimist. But I see, even in the business schools, I see students much more interested in working for nonprofits, working for Teach for America, you know, going out and doing something good in the world. And that's something that I think, as business faculty, we need to be emphasizing. Because, I'll toot my own horn here for a second, you need management skills in whatever endeavor you're doing, whether it's the theater, whether it's a nonprofit organization, whether it's Lutheran World Relief. You need people to know how to utilize assets efficiently and do the things that need to be done. And so it's a good launching ground for that. Ron?
I would hope that we all could, as teachers, I'm an educator as well, pass on the benefits of being socially responsible to all of our students in whatever the classes we teach. But relying on education to lead the way is key, but there's a huge problem with that, and that, remember, all of our textbooks are put out by corporations.
Corporations in Texas.
Have you been following?
No, like two or three. You know, just
have you been following the Texas textbook?
Yeah, it's scary. It's really scary. And
can you explain that for us, we who don't know what went on?
Explain
the Texas textbook.
I'll tell you a personal story. When I was in my PhD program, the chair of my dissertation committee was trained as a sociologist, not in business. And there are lots of connections. But John, his name's John Shepherd, John had one of the top-selling introductory sociology textbooks for college. And, you know, every two or three years, the publisher would ask him to update it, which is how I got involved in it. I was the one that went out and checked the new statistics. For all that. But his publisher then asked him, well, let's take your college textbook and transform it into a high school textbook. And so we spent a summer doing that, and we sent it off to the publisher, everything looks cool. And about 6 months later, John gets a call back from the publisher saying, we've got a problem. The Texas School Board is reviewing your textbook, and Texas is like the largest purchaser of high school textbooks. And it seems like there are no homosexuals in Texas. So you gotta take all references to homosexuality out of the textbook. And that was the first of five or six different things that we had to eliminate from the textbook.
They had to change maps that are more current.
What's wrong with a map? What's controversial about a map?
Yeah.
Oh, maps of not state boundary maps, but you know, maps showing different income levels or whatever by state.
Demographics.
So there is a very strong component in Texas that wants to make the textbooks what they want them to be
by evolution.
We are officially out of time. I'd love to stay here and talk if you want to. Mary Ellen, you had a hand up and a hand.
Well, I just think one thing too, in listening and not to realizing that I'm in a room full of educators. But I think one of the things that we have to look, or that you have to look at, and you have to discuss when we use these five words, are we talking universal or nationally, or are we talking intimate group? Because I personally, and this is for you educators, I personally think the best education my children's going to get is from my husband and I. So education globally, education Texas-wise is one thing, but what I'm going to teach them in education about economy and family and religion is much more important to me than what Texas has to offer.
And it also sticks a lot more, what mom and dad teach.
Right. Yeah. So I think
back to the young lady's observation about the breakdown.
Right, I think you have to look at those five things. Are they these huge global things, or are they intimate?
Well, I talk about them on a national or global level, because unfortunately there aren't a whole lot of families that take your husband's approach to it.
Right, and understanding that. But
I think that points back to your question, what can we as Christians do? We can emphasize family, we can educate our kids, we can educate our neighbors, you know, if their parents are, you know, you can just love them into a quality life, and just set some great examples.
Mary Lett, still your chance.
Well, you know, I'm interested in a future discussion posing the microfinance, which is something that I'm seeing a lot of young people interested in,
yeah,
in terms of business, and looking at that as an ideal, and yet also seeing these crushing big companies, you know, which becomes a spiritual and, you know, how do you survive in business idealistically? That's a question I have.
That is a real dilemma for a lot of our young people.
And I think it's...
Mm-hmm. The need to make a living versus the need to do something
that
you feel good about.
It's the stuff of which many plays are made.